In taping these lectures by Father John Hardin, S.J., on the principles and practice of formation in the religious life, it has been necessary from time to time to retape or re-record because of excessive tape or surface noise. The substitute voice is Robert Warnock, but the ideas, the words, the conclusions are all Father John Hardin, S.J., namely, how to distinguish temptations from inspiration. First, a question: how to distinguish temptations from inspirations? First, let us describe each term. And I would like to emphasize the importance of a clear definition for our purpose of temptation on the one hand and inspiration on the other. And here I am speaking as a man trained in the spirituality of St. Ignatius. Others would put it differently. And this is the way we were taught. Temptation. A temptation is an impulse permitted by God, but instigated by the devil, with the devil using our concupiscence or the bad example of others, urging us to commit sin. This is a definition of temptation that, if properly understood, can save you a lot of grief and help you in many ways. A temptation is an impulse permitted by God, instigated by the devil, and using our concupiscence or the bad example of others, urging us to commit sin. What then is an inspiration? Inspiration is an impulse originated by the Holy Spirit and using our good tendencies or the good example of others, urging us to practice virtue. Inspiration is an impulse originated by the Holy Spirit, using our good tendencies or the good example of others, urging us to practice virtue. You'll notice in both cases we postulate that behind the temptation is somehow the evil spirit, and behind every inspiration is the Holy Spirit. This is the theology of St. Ignatius. What do we mean when we say how to distinguish? What we mean by that is how to recognize the source of our impulses. We've got all sorts of urges, impulses. You name them, we've got them. The point behind this distinction is to distinguish by recognizing the source of the impulse. Whether the impulses we experience are from the devil or from the Holy Spirit. And I always pick the devil first, because once you recognize the devil, the opposite is recognizing the Holy Spirit. This subject is the bottom line of the spiritual life. All the goodwill, all the generosity in the world can be wasted effort unless my mind is able to distinguish between impulse and impulse, between urge and urge. So I've got the urge. So I'm being impelled to do this or not to do that. I am bursting with generosity, but I'm not sure whether the impulse is a good one. And not all inspirations, when experienced, are holy impulses. Not all temptations, when experienced, are sinful. That's where the subtlety of the religious life belongs. The voice urging virtue can cause us pain, and temptation can give us great satisfaction. So another way of putting this, how to discern the difference between the origin of our desires, whether this origin is demonic or divine. Just because I have a strong, powerful desire to practice an act of charity does not ipso facto mean that that desire is from God. Otherwise, the spiritual life would be simplicity itself, and it isn't. It is highly complex. Now, two presuppositions. And first, the meaning of each. Now, what do we mean by how to distinguish? What are we talking about? And the point is, what are the presuppositions of what we are talking about? There are two. First, the supposition, all our desires, unless we're unconscious, wide awake desires, all our desires are being constantly influenced by intelligent forces outside of our own mind and will. That's the ABC of the spiritual life. None of our thoughts in the mind, none of our desires in the will, are ever entirely just our own. It takes faith to believe it, but you better believe it. The second presupposition. These forces that are at work outside of our mind and will are ultimately God or the devil. The adverb ultimately is important because both God and the evil spirit use our nature. In one case, to inspire, in the other case, to instigate, and use other people, use the weather outside, use the time of the day, use you name it, what. But the focus of our reflections on how to distinguish temptations from inspirations presupposes what Ignatius told his followers to never forget, and never teach anyone in the spiritual life without making this clear. And as I hope, faithful son of Ignatius, I am trying to make it clear. Our minds are never operating alone. Our wills are never acting alone. That behind the mind and the will are ultimately whatever other proximate forces are at work, ultimately the good spirit and the evil spirit. Now the rules for discernment. Before I go on, I'd like to recommend to you, if you don't have copies of this, get it. It's due for revision and reprint, but the publisher just hasn't been able to get to it. I'm talking about the book, All My Liberty, chapter 12, pages 131 to 143, on the discernment of spirits. The single most practical thing we should know, single most practical thing in the spiritual life. Read what's there, because I will touch on some of the items but go beyond it, because I will be assuming that you either have or will have access to that chapter. All I know is that living as a priest And the 18th of June, I'll be a priest 35 years. God has been very good to me and gave me a great master of the spiritual life as my novice master and what we call cushion master. That's the third year of novitiate that we make after our ordination. And as a priest, he urged me and helped me to set down for myself, and each one of us is different, basic rules for the discernment of spirits. You will never do anything great for God, never, unless you have mastered what's behind this discernment of spirits. All the saints were masters of discernment, because the God who inspires us is the hidden God, and the devil who tempts us is very clever. And we better be able to recognize God, though hidden, when he is acting on us, and the devil when he tries to influence our actions. There are three basic principles for discernment. One of the books that, if the Lord spares me, I would like to write is a good practical manual on the discernment of spirits. I've seen good people ruin their lives and the lives of others for failure to discern in the mind. First basic principle. God and the angels, and God uses the angels, the good angels, on the one hand, and the devil and his agents on the other hand. I don't hesitate, and I say this knowing that I'm being recorded, and the recording will be copied. Andrew Greeley is an agent of the devil. I say this with complete certitude. So God and the angels on the one hand, the devil and his angels on the other, act according to their respective natures. First clue. In other words, God, when he acts on the human soul, always acts like God. And the devil, when he acts on the soul, acts like the devil. Second principle. The good and evil spirits, for Ignatius, it is always plural. Good spirits, singular, and evil spirits, plural. But the good spirit, for Ignatius, is both God and his angels, so we can pluralize both. Good spirits and evil spirits. Whenever they act on a human soul, they always act for opposite purposes. They have not just different, but contrary motives. And third principle, both kinds of spirits adapt themselves to persons, occasions, and circumstances. In other words, the Holy Spirit and his angels adapt themselves to the person, and so does the evil spirit. First of all, and this is always, the good spirit knows better than we what kind of people we are. And the evil spirits try their best to find out. You say the wrong thing to the wrong person at the wrong time, and you get no action. The purpose of the influence from both God and his angels, and the devil and his agents, is to get action. So adaptation is built into the way the good and the evil spirits influence our lives. Now, some practical norms. What are some of the signs by which we can recognize a temptation? Well, let me preface this with a very important parenthesis. I am speaking to people who want to do God's will, who are serious about divine grace being an invitation, inviting our response. Because unless we make that distinction, nothing really works. Let's go back to our third basic principle, adaptation. In general, I never tire of repeating this, no matter how many times I may have told people, because I've got to keep telling myself. For a person who is not serious about doing God's will, God and the devil act in different ways. We said both adapt themselves. They sure do. What kind of adaptation would you expect the devil to make with sinful people? What does the devil want these people to do? What they're doing. The last thing the devil wants to do is to disturb their peace of mind. What he wants is to induce complacency, smugness. He doesn't want anything to ruffle the untroubled, perverse conscience which this person is living with. Now, we won't finish this vast subject today, but let me just illustrate by an experience I've had within the last 2 days. There is a father whom I have been, well, he's a father of a family that I've been counseling spiritually for a dozen or more years. He lives at some distance, but he welcomes my advice. He has a boy who's gone off the deep end. In his 20s, he's gone on drugs, and God knows what kind of a life he's living. He went out to the West Coast to be as far away as possible from the family, living in some flop house, and just causing great anguish to his parents. I promised the father I would investigate in New York from what I knew was the best expert in dealing with this kind of person. It happens to be a Father Daniel Egan. You might remember that. A Franciscan. I happened to reach him, explained the situation to him, and here's what he told me. There is no power on earth that will change that boy unless something shakes him out of his complacency. Either you must wait until God does something drastic in his life to wake him up, or that somehow you might create a situation to shock him. He said, I'm not recommending this, but he said it might possibly work. Most of these people on drugs have committed some crime by now. The police has so many of these people on their roster. The jails are too crowded. They can't possibly arrest them all. If the family has a police connection in California and some friend on the police force who would, having studied the case, shock the boy into telling him why he is in trouble with the law, well, unless the young man is frightened, nothing will change his life. So how are we going to expect the evil spirits with people who are living in sin to operate? Well, like the evil spirits. A person living an evil life is what the devil wants. Keep the person that way. Whereas the good spirits with people who are living evil lives, what term do we have that goes back to our maybe childhood days when a person is in sin and God is trying to arouse that person from his state of sin. Well, what do we call that? Finish the sentence. Blank of conscience. What kind of a conscience would God cause a person who is living in sin to have so that he would come out of his evil state? A troubled conscience. We better learn at least. See, the devils go through instruction. You know that, don't you? They get trained by Lucifer. And this is the first thing that Lucifer teaches his underlings. Do not allow anything to trouble the conscience of a person who is doing our demonic will. God then causes trouble. Pangs of conscience. Have you heard that before? Well, if we're trying to do God's will, what do you expect the evil spirit to cause in us? The evil spirit, how do you expect him to act on people who are trying to do God's will? To cause them what? Trouble. Difficulty. Anxiety. Worry. Sadness. This is not a sentence I've just said. This is the bedrock, the single most practically important principle in the spiritual life. To know this and believe it is to be on the road to sanctity. If you find yourself habitually disturbed or worried by something, though you want to do God's will, assume, just assume, it is not caused by God, but caused by the evil spirits. What are we talking about? We're asking how we can discern or distinguish between the operation of the good spirit and the operation of the evil spirit in our lives and specifically on our minds. As we mentioned before, our minds are never alone, never uninfluenced by spiritual forces outside of us. They are constantly being affected by the good spirit, who is God and his angels, and the evil spirit, who is Satan and his minions. The three basic principles, then, are that God and the angels on the one hand and the devil and his agents on the other act according to their respective natures. God's influence is always good. The devil's influence is always evil. Second, the good and evil spirits, being different in nature, act for opposite purposes. The good spirit, that is, the Holy Spirit and the angels, are always intent on our moral improvement and doing God's will. The evil spirit is always intent on our destruction and the commission of sin. And third, each set of spirits adapts themselves, that is, they adjust to different persons, different occasions, and different circumstances. Both the good and evil spirits are very adaptable. Given those three principles now, we want to look at some practical norms. Concretely, how can we, as far as it is possible, for us to distinguish, recognize, first, a temptation? In other words, what are signs of temptation? We're looking at the kind of thoughts that we're having. First, sign of a temptation, if that which is in our mind or stimulated in our mind by what we see, hear, or read about is against the church's teaching. So the first sure sign of a temptation is if that which, or we're not sure if it's a temptation, if it's against the church's teaching. Second, if it is against the church's approval. In other words, there are many things which the church does not formally teach, but which she does approve. Thirdly, is it against obedience, depending on my state of life? And this, when I speak to married people, applies, for example, to children. When they want to do whatever they want to do contrary to their parents' wishes, the odds are that's a temptation. But I liked it. That's not the point. Does mother like it? No, she doesn't like it. Well then, a little child, you are being tempted. Fourth, if always assuming that a person wants to do God's will, if that which I am being inclined or urged to do deprives me of peace, confidence in God, even confidence in myself, and the spiritual joy I had before I had these thoughts or had read this book, or had heard this conference. For some unaccountable reason, for example, a person says, I just read a book. It was thrilling, but it bothers me. Are you trying to do God's will? Of course I am. Well, without going into a long brown study as to just what in that book is wrong, if it deprives you of the peace of mind you had before you read the book, the odds are there is something in that book which is a temptation. Fifth, if correspondingly my habitual intention is to do God's will, if the thoughts on my mind or the persons in my life or the circumstances in which I find myself cause me anxiety, worry, or sadness, the odds are that the cause of my worry and anxiety and sadness is at root a temptation. Number six, if the thoughts I have or the inclinations favor my own selfish satisfaction, the odds are that that which I am inclined or urged to do is a temptation. It is not a divine inspiration. The evil spirit always seeks to have the person satisfy himself selfishly. In other words, temptation to selfishness is from the evil spirit. Number seven, if whatever the thoughts or desires I have cause me doubt, I am less sure about what I have been, especially in matters of my faith and morality, I am now less sure than I was before, I may put down the source of that doubt to the evil spirit. So much then, very briefly, for some practical norms of recognizing demonic temptations. Now, signs of inspiration. Again, the question arises, how can I tell? I have these thoughts. I've been doing this reading. There are certain persons who enter my life. and they give rise to certain sentiments, outlook, thoughts, and inclinations. I'm really not sure whether the person, place, or thing, and the ideas in my mind, and the desires stimulated in my will, are from God. Well, I should be able to tell. Here are some signs. First, I may be sure and secure in believing that it is an inspiration if that about which I am wondering is nevertheless according to church's teaching. If it is, it is a sign of a divine inspiration. Another sign, it is a practice or question. Do I know whether that which I am being urged or inclined to do has been practiced by the saints? If it has, the odds are it is an inspiration, though I am not yet a saint. Nevertheless, I want to become a saint. One way to become a saint is by imitating the saintly men, women, and children in the church's history. No doubt there are some practices of the faith that are not meant for everyone. However, it is a very good custom to read lives of the saints regularly, and I would say daily, especially those whose state of life and experience somewhat conforms to my own. And the more of these I read, and I have now for some 40 years tried to read something from some saint every day. That's a lot of reading. What happens? You gradually learn to live in the company of holy people. And while it's nice to have saintly people immediately in your company, well, we don't always have that luxury. The next best thing is to read the lives of the saints. The third sign of inspiration, if what I am doing or inclined to do is according to the practice of good Catholics. In other words, I'm not sure whether this is from God. Are there good Catholics, however, that do it? There are. Very well, I have a secure norm in following people whose lives of virtue I admire. Fourth, and for religious, this is an infallible sign. Does it correspond to my rule of life? That's why, quite frankly and simply, the church goes to such pains to make sure that a rule of life for a religious institute, is approved by the Holy See. Because if it is, then I have a ready, available norm for knowing if it is God's will or not. And that is also wise for those who are not religious, that they have a rule of life to follow. Yesterday, after our executive committee meeting for the Institute on Religious Life, I was taken to Kenosha, Wisconsin. I was there until after 11 last night, conferring with the people who are learning the Apostolate for Family Consecration. and got back in time to prepare my notes for today. Well, the one thing that I have been telling lay people, not unlike religious, you are to have a program or rule of life. Spares you a lot of time, a lot of trouble, a lot of worry. I want to do something. Does it correspond to what I'm supposed to do? Number five. Do the ideas or the inclinations to which I am subject and about which I am wondering, are they from God or not? Do they correspond to the charism for religious or their founder? And I would say for lay people in the world, too, because even though they don't belong to a religious institute, they are to, however, follow in the charism of some great spiritual master, like Benedict, or Francis, or Ignatius. That's why all religious institutes over the centuries have had their lay counterparts. And that's why every religious community in the church today should have its lay counterpart that will offer those who are not, say, religious under vows, a tried and secure method of recognizing God's inspiration. We should all have some program of life, so we just don't coast or drift or wander. I cannot exaggerate the importance of this. This is not just for religious, though sadly it's not for all religious today. The main reason, the main single reason, and there are thousands of other reasons, but I think the main single reason why there's been so much disintegration in religious communities is that the members of those communities do not have a set program or plan or rule of life against which then religious can determine whether what they would like to do is from God or not. Does it correspond to my program of life? Lay people, that is one word that after 35 years that I've been ordained, and by next Friday the 35 years will be accomplished, there is one word that identifies people who are living a good life, and that is order, an orderly life. Why I should have some plan, some order, based on the church's teaching and following in the footsteps of some great spiritual master. Whatever I teach, whatever I touch, I don't footnote it always. But it is always and invariably within the ambit of the spirituality of St. Ignatius. Whether you realize it or not, you're being indoctrinated. Except that Ignatius himself, being, in the tradition of the great masters of the spiritual life before him, he is therefore giving us the church's directives. Now, number six, the signs of inspiration. And here I have seven. Always assuming that I want to do God's will, that premise is indispensable. I honestly want to do God's will. All right. I'm not sure now what I want to decide, whether the ideas and inclinations I have are from God. They are from God if they give what? First, peace. Second, joy. Third, tranquility. Fourth, confidence. Fifth, resignation. Sixth, patience. Seventh, certitude. Each of those could be further subdivided into seven more divisions. Peace, joy, tranquility, confidence, resignation, patience, and certitude. When God or his angels visit the soul, remember, the soul that wants to do his will, it would be, to coin an expression, folly on the part of God to not give peace or joy or tranquility or confidence. He loves us, and if we're trying to do his will, we love him. And how do you treat your friends? This is a friend dealing with a friend. These are the seven, well, how many colors are there to the spectrum? Seven? Vibigior. Violet, indigo, blue, green, yellow, orange, and red. Seven. These are the seven colors to the spectrum of divine grace. To believe this and act on it is to have come into a great treasure. The precondition is up to you. Try to do God's will. You honestly try to do God's will, and you can relax. Whatever enters my mind, but there are a thousand times a thousand things that enter my mind. No matter. Universal. Whatever enters your mind that gives you peace and the rest, you can be assured it is God dealing with you as a friend. This sixth norm, as you can see immediately, is a broad-ranging one. And it is an internal, subjective, psychologically identifiable norm on which, with God's grace, I've been trying to live over the years. All I can tell you is, it works. Now, a seventh norm, and we're still on the signs of inspiration. Does it call for sacrifice, which is the opposite of a temptation? If it calls for sacrifice, the odds are it comes from God. So leave it to God to give us a chance to adore. We use the words without a second thought, his adorable will. My friends, that's the most important and constant act of adoration we're called upon to make, to sacrifice our will to his. And that is adoration of the highest order. That's what surrender of my will to God's will is. It is adoration. And what adoration that is. Finally, the obverse, you might say, of selfish satisfaction does what I am inclined or inspired
or I think I am inspired to do, call for selflessness. If it does, the odds are it is from God. And this is where other people are such great and constant help in assuring us that something is God's will. They'll put demands on our selflessness. Leave it to other people. Frequently, and some even heroically. The last thing I wanted to do last night was to go to Kenosha, Wisconsin. And as we stepped outside, my driver, who picked me up, I asked him, "Is that your car on the right?" "No, it's the one on the left." It wasn't a car, it was a van. Now, vans can be comfortable. This one was not. As he said, it's still running. He had bought it in 1971. When I got to Kenosha, I sat down to a meal. Immediately, papers were spread out, and we talked till after 11. Fortunately, I was able to get some sleep. Got up. Before I left, well, there were three long-distance phone calls in the interest of the people who invited me. And I've got a class at 10 o'clock. He smiled and then proposed something else. And finally I left and finished what I was doing for the persons who had invited me in the bumpy van. And also wrote the quiz for tomorrow's class. It's on Inter Mirifica, one of the documents of Vatican II on the media. Well, all kinds of calls for selflessness. God must be around somewhere. And the more things you like to do, and the more things you hate to do, the easier it is to recognize a divine inspiration. God is constantly calling us to do what we don't like and to give up what we do like. So much on how to distinguish temptations and inspirations.